Welcome to Local Share Green Action Podcast. This show is produced by Go Green Locally, a 501c3 nonprofit providing tools and resources for people that are looking for ways to take even more successful local action that makes a difference for our people and our planet. I'm excited to be speaking with a man who has been working in invasive species removal for many years. He approaches invasive plant management with a philosophy far removed from the traditional spray and kill mindset. Instead of quick fixes, he works with the land over time, transitioning landscapes step by step so that invasive species slowly lose their foothold and native plants can reclaim their place. I'm speaking with Mike Bald, who is the founder and owner of Got Weeds, based in central Vermont. Mike's method is rooted in patience, observation, and ecological understanding, resulting in long-term restoration rather than temporary suppression. Based in Vermont and working throughout New England, he manages terrestrial invasive species and carries out this work safely, effectively, and without reliance on chemicals. He also trains land stewards, homeowners, and professionals on how to do this work. Mike meticulously documents his treatments, and he shares his findings at conferences and workshops across New England, the Midwest, and even Ireland. Years of practice and on-the-ground evidence have shown that non-chemical invasive plant control is not only possible, but it is preferred approach for land owners committed to the true stewardship. His core message is simple and powerful. Stewardship equals presence. Though trained as a biologist, Mike sees his role as reading the landscape, understanding the natural dynamics at play, and responding to them thoughtfully. His work focuses on reducing ecological stressors, improving soil health, supporting native species, and gently and relentlessly suppressing invasive species. He continually experiments with varied methods to address the unique mix of invasive species on each site, and he shares these insights widely to empower landowners, expand community awareness, and build collective capacity for ecological care. Mike, welcome to our show. It is so nice to be able to speak with you today.
Thank you so much, Jenny. Thank you. It's a pleasure, an honor. A joy. So yeah, let's chat.
All right. Well, I'm excited to find out more about your path of eco-action that led to you founding Got Weeds and transitioning invasive weeds to native species without relying on chemical herbicides. So what sparked your interest in biology and taking steps and taking action in land stewardship originally?
Oh boy. The path, I guess you would say, is long, perhaps interesting. I think it really traces back to being curious about what I'm eating, you know, what I'm eating and drinking, and where does my food come from? Because, I mean, I had plenty of time outdoors as a kid, climbing and scrambling, and I mean, you know, the magnetism of the outdoors has always been there. But I will say that, say 30 years ago, just getting to know more and more farmers, moving to Vermont with two small children, and then really just getting fascinated with, you know, I need to know what we're eating here. And it's, you know, there's the world of organic, and just whether you're certified or not is its own thing, but just making sure that we're putting in healthy choices, putting into our bodies, you know, healthy, the healthiest options we can get, a good diverse diet, but knowing your farmer, knowing where the food comes from, talking to, just sharing back and forth between people, how do you grow this or grow that, and what are the best things you can do for the land and the animals and the plants and the people that live there. So that's it. Food certainly was the draw, or the thing that pushed me. I have to give credit, I always give credit to the state of Massachusetts with good people energy. And just so many great conferences on soil health and biodiversity and the Organic Farming Association. Every state has a chapter. So I would just drive home to Vermont thinking to myself, can we not manage more than just farming and agriculture in an organic manner? Can we not just kind of extend that beyond and treat all landscapes maybe a little more thoughtfully, mindfully? And I was not seeing that embraced or discussed or addressed at all. So at that point, I was working in the Forest Service, US Forest Service, and I had all that inspiration, again, from the agricultural community and from colleagues in Massachusetts. And I kind of stepped off, took the plunge, and went 100%. Somehow came up with the name for the company and created the t-shirt. You gotta have the swag or the t-shirt, whatever. And been running with it ever since. It's just brilliant.
Excellent. Can you give us maybe a short synopsis of what Got Weeds does for people in the land?
Sure. What I offer to people from the get-go, it has always been making myself available to show and demonstrate to landowners, to businesses, municipalities, how they can manage their land, farms included, but land in general, how they can do it without pesticides, without having to go the heavy-handed approaches. There are so many approaches out there, flaming, tilling, pesticides, repeat cutting, repeat stressing, grazing, browsing. Some of the methods are heavier, more aggressive than others. I did not mention solarizing, using heat, smothering. But my intention has always been not to leave a legacy on the land in terms of toxic breakdown metabolites or residues. Basically, leave no trace. Show the landowner, whether they want to hire me or not, show them how to get to the vision that they share, what we can do on their land, and what we might ought not do. And then I just lay out a progression over several years how they can get there. And then I think this is a really fun part is to benchmark and track the work over time with perhaps a photograph or a couple of photographs that demonstrate certain species being suppressed and moved out of the picture, while the native species that are already in place or that we may install, those begin to spread and thrive and do much better. So it's capturing transition over time.
So, what originally pulled you into this work? I know you kind of covered a little bit of it, but was there a particular moment or study or experience that convinced you to commit to removing invasive plants ecologically? Were you ever on the side of using chemicals, even if it was organic, where you decided, no, I don't think we need chemicals?
Yes, I appreciate the question. The Forest Service is a land management agency, and one particular botanist got me into the world of invasive species. So I'm grateful for that. And she recognized that I was in the river all the time, and I knew some of the landscapes really well. So maybe she saw that in me that although I've never taken a course in botany, which is troubling, I know, but the introduction to land management as it unfolded with the Forest Service and with farmers included for them, not for me, the use of herbicides and chemicals, and it was kind of an accepted practice or best management practice. And I even went through and got certification. So I've actually been through the pesticide certification process. And I mean, I have enough chemistry background, biology background. I'm not going to brag that I have a whole lot of physics background, but I do have enough to prune trees successfully. But I just wondered, if you look big picture and you look, everything's interconnected, and you can't tug on one thing without impacting the entire web of life. I was curious. So to answer your question directly, yes, I read two books. I read one over the course of a Christmas holiday. I won't state the name of the company because they don't say my name and I don't say their name. But it's The World According to Mann, dot, dot, dot. The company that was purchased by a large German international corporation several years ago. So the French investigative reporter who wrote that book is brilliant. Again, the title is The World According to Mann. You can
Gotcha.
finish it off. And so that was in 2009, 2010. I basically put the wheels in motion in 2010. But previously, or maybe roughly, simultaneously with that, I read Our Stolen Future, which was published in the early 90s. Theo Kullburn is the lead name. And that's a difficult read. They're both actually difficult books. I tell people if you're going to read The World According to, don't eat before you read it, and you're not going to want to eat when you're done having completed it. But Our Stolen Future is very technical, and you really have to. I put it down many times and then had to pick it back up. But we were running into these issues, these problems with chemical contamination in the 80s and 90s, and it was just, I mean, Silver Spring came out and may have been the first warning flag for us, but Our Stolen Future shows 50 years of data how we're in deep trouble. And that was 40 years ago. So what have we done since then? Not much.
So, what invasive species are you dealing with most in Vermont right now? Can you explain maybe the frustrations that landowners who don't know about your methods?
Sure. I do get this question a lot, Mike. What is the most problematic, the most troublesome, the most important, you might say. And so I give people the three-pronged answer because I tend to cluster things in groups of three. Japanese knotweed is the bamboo-like plant that essentially creates monocultures in waterways, riparian areas. I mean, it can grow. It's pretty general. It can handle a lot of different types of landscape, but it's particularly problematic around streams and rivers where it tends to dominate, and then you get no trees around the river. You literally get no forest regeneration, which leads to high water temperature, which leads to no fish reproduction and essentially dead rivers. So Japanese knotweed is up there on top. But the other two plants for me personally are Oriental slash Asiatic bittersweet, which is a vine, but I will cluster a couple different vine species into the mix here and say that we are absolutely totally ignoring vine species, exotic ones from beyond North America. And they're absolutely destroying our tree canopies. And you get a heavy snow or strong winds or hurricane, whatever it is, and we're losing our forest, our big trees, and certainly our edge trees that already have a bit of a lean to them. So the damage is just off the charts. And then you get no regeneration of new growth because Bambi comes through and eats everything that's trying to come out of the soil. Earthworms are eating everything they can get for topsoil. And then with ground vines and canopy vines literally choking out everything else, I've seen some pretty awful pictures, and I've got a few pictures. So I'm waving the flag as aggressively as I can here, telling people, it's not just kudzu, it's not just bittersweet. We need to pay attention to vines of every species. Poison ivy is our native, and it has its place. I don't actually deal with poison ivy, except in a friendly manner, hopefully. But even poison ivy as a native has really gotten aggressive because of CO2 in the atmosphere. That has been formally studied. I would like to just, if we have a moment, to just say there is a third category. I speak in threes. So I said Japanese knotweed, the vine family, and then thirdly would be the herbaceous plants, particularly the ones that are phototoxic to people's skin. I have just seen so many examples of roadsides and access paths to go play in the pond or whatever. And you cannot literally walk down the path 50 feet without brushing against, a dozen of these plants and getting sap on your skin and getting that in your eyes or burning, these scars. I've had them. The scars on your skin can last a year, a deep purple scar and heavy blisters. It's why we are allowing that to take over our landscape. Wild parsnip is the wild parsnip is the poster child for that. As it's in the giant hogweed family. And nothing against a plant. It's not evil, it's not bad, it's just doing what it does. But for us to sit back and just let it take over seems really to be an odd choice for me. So those are my lead ones. And do you want to hear some of the frustrations?
Yeah, I'm imagining you have like clients that were initially skeptical that you could successfully manage large areas of land without using chemicals until they saw it themselves.
I think the biggest skepticism or obstacle, and I get it professionally, I get challenged all the time by academia or nonprofits or state, federal professionals. People tell me, they don't ask, they just tell me you can't operate at scale. And I tell them, well, first of all, I don't know that I've ever seen you out there, so I don't know what your basis is, but that's fine. No, we can take it. The biggest challenge is people failing to appreciate the length of time, the commitment to just lower the shoulder and commit to doing this over a 5 year or 10 year time frame. And when you point out the fact that many of the seed lifespans of these plants, the lifespan is 5 to 10 years, well, it should come as no surprise then that it's going to take 5, 6, 8 years to successfully transition this particular patch of ground or this long linear stretch of riverbank. I mean, why would we think it takes any less time than the seed life? So once people actually grasp that, they just, I mean, I have a lot of clients who simply, I try to get people outdoors and say, come on, I want to show you this. Try to get them engaged. Some people are into it, other people are not. And I mean, I do have several who just say, give me a limit, give me the budget for the year, which I do, and say, we're going to stay under 5,000 or under 2,000. And if something comes up, I'll come back and tell you, hey, we've got a runaway situation in, the eastern pasture or whatever. On the hilltop over there. And I mean, they're not obligated to spend $5,000, but they know that I'm out there. I think they actually, I suspect they might actually take some comfort in that. And while I do want them out and engaged, they happily feel like, well, Mike's got a handle on it. He's not going to let anything happen that will turn into a crisis. And he knows to come to us if we need more people power or funding or to change our methodologies or whatever. That said, my goal has always been to empower people to do the work themselves and not to necessarily feel tied to me. So I've always been happy to empower them to use, to do the work themselves or to hire their kids or their neighbors' kids or to work with community organizations and, I mean, make it a community learning. Give other people the opportunity to experience and to learn. I actually enjoyed Amy's your last interview and how emphatic she was on the issue of specificity, how everything really adapts and thrives or fails to thrive in a location with all the specifics there. The more time we're out there, the more time you spend, the more times you see Japanese knotweed in 50 different places, the more opportunities you have to see why certain things happen and why certain things don't happen. And it makes you ask, what's going on here? What's the dynamic? There's got to be an explanation, and it's up to me to find it. That's the challenge, and I try to spread that to everybody I encounter.
Do you get into maybe the negative aspects of synthetic herbicides, or do you find, or like help educate the public, or do you find that people kind of already have a basis for that understanding and that's why they're talking to you in the first place? Or is it kind of a mix depending on if you're at a conference or wherever you are?
Thank you for the question. People know my approach. I have been doing this for, well, with my company, I've been doing it for, this will be the 16th growing season approaching next year, celebrating that. But I have been involved with invasive, terrestrial invasive plants for over 20 years. And people know my perspective and my time frames. They know that I have a network of people that I've helped directly or indirectly start similar businesses. One lady in particular, browsing with goats. So there is now a little crew of us. We're all independent. We are more than happy to refer each other. And I mean, I will not take on a job if it's a better fit for somebody else. I will say, hey, she's got a great approach here that will work on your landscape. You don't need me. You need to get her out here, particularly in the springtime, or this will be a good fit for the fall. Again, we look at the land and say, here I would do this, there I would do that. You might flame this area, but don't even think about putting fire over there. So it's, you know, I can write it up for people and do a formal plan, but it's so nuanced. And I think the thing about the chemical world, I try to stay neutral and acknowledge, yes, integrated pest management is a thing. We have to be careful not to hide behind it and fall into a mindset that erases our curiosity and just, well, we're just going to go out and spray it, you know, for the next 3 years and it'll take care of itself. No, you actually have to get involved and you actually have to dive in a little deeper and figure out what you're going to put in place of once you've started suppressing the exotic plants. So it's a conversation that should be complex and people try to oversimplify. And I just try to give them the very basic, my little kernel of learned wisdom, say it that way. Which is, if you care about climate change and if you're really honestly trying to do best for the land, acknowledging that it's degraded and depleted and it is suffering through centuries of our kind of overuse or overexploitation, if that's your start point, why would you turn to the toxic option first? Why not go with grazing or something that's not going to leave a legacy? I mean, herbicides can be specific, but they, again, I have pictures. They can also go beyond what they're intended for. People are inherently sloppy. You know, you always ask people, where are you going to wash your equipment? You know, I see what you intend to do, but are you going to come back three more times and hit the same patch of ground? And if that calcium and magnesium is going to get bound up on the herbicide products, breakdown products, is that calcium then no longer available to the native plants? If it's already bound up, you're taking that important nutrient out of the equation. Is that what's happening here? And if you really care about global warming, you will recognize that anytime we use pesticides, the manufacture of them, the distribution, the application on the land with plastic tanks and spray nozzles and everything else, and their final breakdown is what I call a five-factor CO2 event. And the fifth factor being that many of them are antimicrobial in nature. So I usually get people to open their eyes or see the other side or see what's under the, you know, behind the curtain when I tell them Phosphorus is necessary for plant growth, and the irony of using it in herbicides, it's a limited resource, right? The irony of using that element to then kill plants when we're having a hard time getting enough of it to grow plants, that's the irony of that is it just makes you step back and say, could we be a little more thoughtful in this?
So, how do most people find out about your work?
How do most people find out about Got Weeds? Well, the t-shirts are popular. Thank you. I do have people come point out on the shirt, it says right on the shirt, Got Weeds, and they tell me how important it is to have the letter S in the name. I'm like, okay. Thanks for the input. But essentially, I don't worry about it anymore. I'm online. I can be found online now that I've been around for more than 10 years. I was probably completely unknown for the first few years. But I speak and I work, as you mentioned, even internationally. I think it's mostly it's my agricultural network. I am just thrilled to go to farmers markets and talk to farmers and learn all the things I don't know because I have only just begun to scratch the surface in my knowledge base. So I just chat with people and hopefully deep dive and see what they're doing. And people put my name out there. I'm grateful for that, but they hear their neighbor talking about something and they say, you just need to get Mike and he'll let you know what he's seen so far and what has worked and what hasn't worked in dealing with giant hogweed or Japanese knotweed. So word of mouth and people who've had a positive experience are more than happy to share my name. And I do want to say I think training, being available as someone to train others in safe work habits, that's what I do for the University of Rhode Island every year. That has proven to be an area of, I guess I'll say, expertise for me. People do want to know, how do we dress to work outdoors? And I mean, we had the video on a minute ago. You can see I always have a bandana around my neck. That's my first aid kit. I have glasses with side wing. I always protect my eyes. I usually wear a leather hat, bush hat outdoors. You never catch me without boots or footwear in Vermont's lovely rivers because the amount of glass and steel that I encounter all the time is ridiculous. So I do a heck of a lot of training and site visits and town and nonprofit or organizational visits where we do a workshop or a demo. And I think when I encourage others just to get started in this business world, I tell them we all have a lot to learn. We all have value. People are just now beginning to appreciate that reading the landscape and seeing the different plant species, what is native and what has been more recently introduced, what problems could arise from that. That skill of reading the landscape has real value. And I don't have to sell myself so much anymore. But in the very beginning, in the early days, I mean, people kind of rolled their eyes thinking that they should pay for me to come do a consult. And I mean, I've had the most recent issue has been people buying property, residential property, and emailing me a year later or a month later to say, "Hi, Mike, we just bought our house and this huge plant is coming up everywhere and I knew nothing about Japanese knotweed, but I mean, do I have to worry about my septic system? Do I have to worry about, my foundation?" And the answer is oftentimes, well, yes, you shouldn't ignore it, but they had no idea what they were buying. So that's a problem.
So when we talked a little bit before this interview, and I thought it was very interesting, some of the methods that you mentioned, how you accomplish transitioning, and that when you're cutting back invasives, that it's opening up for sunlight and things like that to reach native seeds, which are maybe in the seed bank. Can you just touch on that a little bit about kind of how you do your work?
Sure. I think the key thing for people to understand is you're not gonna detect real change, real transition until you get into the third year of being present, being engaged on the landscape. So for me, whatever I'm tackling, my first goal really is to break seed production, or you might say seed introduction, which is fruiting of the mature plants. I cannot stop Bambi, the deer. I cannot stop Munchie the woodchuck or squirrels or anybody else from running through and dropping seeds on your land. But I can certainly prevent buckthorn shrubs, trees. Wild parsnip will crank out 5, 10,000 seeds on one plant. So until we stop production, seed rain is what that's called, we're not getting anywhere. I mean, I guess I try to impart this skill to people. You should know which way the wind blows, and you should know which way the mowing deck, which way does the town come through when they're mowing the roadsides? They are probably catching things in their deck and dragging them down the road onto your land. So that's the direction of propagation, of transmission. So you work with that. But you really see results in year three when the bigger mature plants are suppressed, they're dying out, they're dying in place. I tend not to pull things out of the ground if it's a tree or shrub. I would rather have them die in place and not disturb the soil, kind of a more regenerative approach. You'll also then have, with that sunlight now hitting the ground, you'll get more of a temperature swing on the ground because it's exposed. You'll get germination of all the seed that's already in the soil. It's already been dropping for 20 or 50 years, so there is a huge seed bank. When that flushes out in years one, two, and three, I just go to ground and just pull thousands at a time. And they're weak. It's an easy, I mean, they're most seedling plants are, kind of cute. And I get past that, and I just pull thousands at a time and dry them. I dispose of them on site. I create a little drying station. And then, since I'm so careful, I don't put any pressure on the natives that are there. So the bee balm and the ironweed and the elderberry is going to be left alone, and I might mulch around it. But by year three, those plants that have been so shaded and suppressed, those actually start to extend their arms and actually start providing shade. And shade is just sunlight management. If I can manage shade and sunlight, I can directly impact. It's like managing water. I can have a major say in what's going on at a particular location. I will even go so far as to keep a lot of vegetation to my south because that's where the sunlight most directly comes from. I will work with southern exposure and kind of manipulate a site and use that to my advantage. And people have just, that's when people usually just say, okay, Mike, just run with it. You know what you're doing. I'll be inside if you need me. You're way over my head. But I try not to get too wonky with people. So anyone can do this work. But all of us, I think, do feel overwhelmed at the beginning. Where do I start? What's most important? How do I stay safe? People are just so thrilled when they see their land actually changing in a positive direction.
So you're usually working with landowners that don't just like have a small yard. We're talking about more acreage, correct?
Yes, the landscapes I typically manage, I mean, I do stay largely terrestrial. There are certainly plenty of species that go right down into the water, so that transition zone from land to water, that's the riparian zone. That's critical. That's there's so much biodiversity there. Thrilled actually to be speaking next summer in Ireland at an aquatic species conference. So we pushed the envelope a little bit and said we're gonna do a presentation that starts where the water begins. It falls out of the sky and hits the ground. way up in the foothills, and all these riparian zones impact water quality and flow and abundance. So I'm going to do a presentation on Japanese knotweed because it has such an impact on those very sensitive riparian zones. But yeah, I manage woodlands, and a lot of times it's meadows going into the woodlands, so that critical woodline area. Deep, I guess I don't get into the swamp too much, but yeah, I farms, municipal properties, town forests. I love working for King Arthur Baking. That's here on the Vermont, New Hampshire border. I do have to be careful about, I have to give people their privacy because in some sense, having certain infestations of plants is not a property positive. Giant hogweed being an example. Although I did have somebody sell their property, and they mentioned in the sales transaction, they said, this property has giant hogweed. Giant hogweed has a 10-year seed life. Mike has been working on this for 8 years. It's completely under control. And it's not something you should continue and finish it off, but this is not an overall negative for the property. And that, I mean, I actually thought that was powerful to demonstrate to the buyers, hey, this is what's going on this property. It would be in your interest to continue on with it.
Yeah, I'm sure that was gave them a reason to ask more questions that they didn't understand that.
Absolutely,
Yeah.
absolutely.
So has your work inspired others to do this work in other parts of the country? And if so, what kind of background or training do you recommend? Maybe formal ecology studies, field knowledge, or something else?
I do work far and wide, as we mentioned, when I go to, say, Cape Cod or Rhode Island or Ireland, it's to share stories and to maybe the nuances of what they deal with in their environment and what they might do to encourage local people, instead of me personally, to start a business and to run with good work locally. I've been in Massachusetts a good bit this summer, and there are easily three subregions where you could have a goat services company just to offer grazing and browsing to landowners. There is a woman doing it now in Vermont, and I think there is a second person. And I just saw a great presentation a month or two ago in Rhode Island, and I mean, she was fascinating to talk to. So there is absolutely room for more people to do this kind of work. I do solarizing with heat. Again, that's nuanced. How do you use, I don't like using plastic, but you can use it multiple times. So, why not use heat to deal with certain settings? Because heat sterilizes the soil, but it does not leave a legacy, and then you can recolonize the soil with bacteria and fungi and the seed supplies that you wish to have. When I keep no secrets, I'm more than happy to share. I've got a little tab on my website about things I've published. I want more people to know this because people have been so generous with me, helping me grow. So I want people to start their own business, take the jump. I think you do have to have initiative and some courage to be self-employed. You certainly have to have medical coverage, and that is probably a huge issue right now, just the way our system works. Because, I mean, there's no shortage of risks. I work alone a lot, and you get the little, I'm exposed to ticks, poison ivy, all of it. But, it's not any more risky than sitting in a chair all day. So that's my take on it. So I encourage people to get the broadest knowledge base they can. And you don't have to be a botanist. It does help. You have to have some understanding of ecology and the fact that things are so interconnected. But I took advantage of my time in working in office settings to learn spreadsheets. And everything I do on everybody, on every client's property goes into my spreadsheet. So when people ask me, how do you, How can you demonstrate that Japanese knotweed does not require chemicals? There's no way to kill this plant. It's evolved on volcanic islands. It's used to getting covered in lava, and it still survives and comes back. And how do you think you're going to beat? Well, I look at my notes. I see what I've got. I see what I'm doing. I see what's working, what's not working. I modify my method, and off I go. So I would tell people, learn how to do spreadsheets, learn how to talk to farmers. I mean, farmers are a gold mine, and speak respectfully with them. Don't ever try to tell anybody what to do, farmers in particular. But there's just so much to learn from people who specialize in mammals and amphibians and definitely water resources. You should, I mean, there's no end to the list. So I would just tell people, get to know your planet better, large scale, and get to know the finer points of where you work. I know that my familiarity does not really extend. There are certainly general guidelines, but I tend to stop. I tend to limit myself to the Adirondacks of New York and down as so far south as the Chesapeake Bay. I mean, that's kind of my natural range, New England. Things are definitely on the move. Species are on the move. Ireland has a lot of the species that we have here. A lot of them are more problematic there than they are here. But the biggest issue I noticed over there, I asked them right away. I said, "You guys don't really get a freeze, a deep freeze in the ground here, do you?" And if you think about Japanese knotweed or just trees and plants going dormant at all, I kind of left this year thinking they almost don't have a dormant season. I mean, they might have, slower activity, but here in New England, things go dormant for, months. But in Ireland, they never get a frost, or they get a frost occasionally, and they might get a freeze a centimeter or two into the ground every other year. And that is a huge difference maker in what goes on below ground. And that directly impacts what goes on above ground. So I think I've been a little bit circular in my response, but I just encourage people to know that it can be intimidating, know that you have value and something to offer, and get out there and be present on the landscape and listen and soak up what's going on. And learning will happen. You'll benefit from that and you'll grow.
So, can you share maybe a challenge that you face in your work and how have you overcome this?
Sure. Yeah, thanks for the question. The biggest challenge for me, I think, would also apply to anyone else, and that's overcoming internally whatever doubts and shortcomings I've had. Not maybe perhaps not confident that I could do it, or maybe not seeing strengths, not seeing weaknesses. You have to be honest with yourself and move forward. I like to say that now that I'm self-employed, I will never work in under any other arrangement, because it's while it is scary and intimidating and challenging, I'm responsible for my own safety, period. I work in a lot of places where there is no cell coverage. I did demolitions in the army. I'm not joking when I say this. I know plenty of farmers. I still have 10 fingers. I know plenty of people who don't. So I'm responsible for everything I say and do every day, the impressions I make and the work that I do. And for some people, that's not a fit. And I get that. I've said this work can be difficult and it can be challenging, but I like to point out that this work is also incredibly therapeutic and fulfilling for a lot of people. So for people who don't learn by traditional means, or who may be disabled, or disabled being a broad term, people who don't get along, just they have social issues, anger management, whatever it is. I explain to people, I come out here every day. I don't go to war. I'm not out here to kill and destroy. This is not a vendetta of any kind. I come out doors, I figure out my loop for the day. I'm totally at peace. I make peace with the poison ivy, say, "Look, I'm not here for you. Can we please just get along?" I go work on the things I am targeting, like the buckthorn and the wild parsnip and the bittersweet vines. And I come in every day, hopefully in one piece, maybe a little bit of aches and pains. And I definitely wash up with soap and water and check for ticks. But I've had so many people just say, I want to, let me know next time you're coming out. I want to come back out. I want to do this again. This has been the best thing, I've done in forever. And it's especially rewarding with young people, youth conservation crews and so forth. And I push them and I push everybody to say, look, there's no reason why a kid in a wheelchair cannot be out here with us. I mean, period. There's room for all of us out here. So let's act on that.
Excellent. Yeah, and I think in a way you've answered my next question, and that is some of the ways, what are some of the ways that you and others are enjoying the rewards of your work? But maybe you can add some additional aspects to that.
The biggest joy that I get out of it is number one, I guess, no, I feel like I'm making a difference. I can see when I talk to people, they feel more positive and they see that I'm making a difference. And then when I love to, I guess that's why I go over there to Ireland, because they just like that I tell stories. But I can weave in some learning points. So I did share most recently that I was out working. I was around a massive oak tree that really did not have a lot of justification for working that area. It was near a wetland, but there was no pressing need to work that area. There was Phragmites in the wetlands nearby. There was wild parsnip growing near the entrance. There was plenty of bittersweet going into the canopy. I mean, I had plenty, and I do work those areas as well. But one of the priority target focus areas for this park was this one particular oak tree. And I sold the city on it. I said, we need to work here. Not for ecological reasons, but for spiritual, personal. This is a people tree. This tree draws people. You can't necessarily see it from the trail, but once we clear out all the honeysuckle and buckthorn, and I had a crew, a youth crew, do it for me, basically with me. They did most of the work. I see at that tree now fairy houses, and people bring the kids out and they build their little elf structures, and I find seashells and all kinds of cool things, which it makes it harder for me to work, of course, because I don't dare knock down a fairy house. That's not good energy. But I was out working one time this year, and I could hear the kids coming along. So there was a little school group out, and I always try not to scare people because I'm kind of the guy in the bushes. So I made myself visible, and I made sure they could see me, and everything was cool. And of course, one of the 10 kids, what are you doing? Kids, what are you, what's that? Who's that dude? So the teachers were gracious enough to let the kids meander over. And I said to the youngsters, I don't know, 9, 10 years old, yeah, this is a big oak tree, and the oak is a very, significant tree in older cultures. There's a lot that goes on in oak trees. And if you look around, you see this is also an oak grove, and there's a lot of importance that goes into a grove of oak trees. So this tree has suffered some damage. It lost some big limbs in the last year. And I want all you kids to know, trees are very generous. They put a lot of the sugar they make into the ground, into the soil, to feed the bacteria. So they are givers. And if we look at this tree, we can see that it's had some damage up in the limbs there. It even has beehives. Honeybees are up there making honey. This tree has a lot of history, and it does a lot for the world around it. But right now it's suffering, and maybe this would be an opportunity for us to give it, some energy. And that's where I stopped. And the kids, without any further words, they all 10 or whatever of them, they just gravitated over to that tree, circled it, put their hands, basically did a group hug on the tree, put their hands on it, gave it some kid energy, and
Thanks.
saddled up and walked away. And I just thought, that's just brilliant. Good for them.
That's cool. Very cool. So, if your ideas and your experience and your wisdom were all wrapped up in seeds of potential action for you to give to others, what advice would you give to others who might like to try this type of work in their communities?
Great question. Number one is see value in yourself, see value in continuing to learn. Certainly don't think that you know everything, but go out, go forward with an air of humility and a willingness to learn and a willingness to share, and just keep the open mind, heart, and just know you're not going to go wrong, because when you do this kind of work, we humans have been doing this kind of work for a very long time, and it has carried us for a very long time. And there's a lot of good. I think that the one point I would make, I kind of made it before. The natural world, we are part of it, and we don't need to do battle against it. So jump in with both feet, be safe, but the mindset is critical, and just go into it with kind of an open mind and not feeling so antagonistic, which I do encounter all the time. But I also encounter plenty of people who see the positives and the balanced approach, and there's no right or wrong in nature. There's only consequence. That's not my quote. That's just something I hold to.
So as we wrap up, is there, you've actually already mentioned some of the great resources in terms of books, but are there maybe any other resources, book, movie, podcast that have been particularly helpful to you?
Sure. I mentioned the two books, and the one thing I would encourage folks anywhere to do is get engaged with other people who are engaged on the land. And that tends to mean farmers, farming associations. The beautiful thing about the Organic Farming Association in New England is that you don't have to be a farmer. You can join it because it's a farming association, not farmers. So if you're drawn to farming and agriculture, and I mean, some people view trees and forests as agriculture, basically living soil, healthy ground, functional landscapes, there are people out there deeply involved in that. So start getting into those circles. You could certainly join the Ecological Landscape Alliance, or any organic farming or regenerative farming association. And maybe tune in to your local. I like to support the idea of engagement at the local level. So people that are doing climate work and thinking about climate change and seeing how things are being impacted and how things are shifting or changing just as the season. Here I am in Vermont. Our growing season has gotten 6 weeks longer. 3 to 6 weeks at each end, actually. So you have to realize that and talk to other people and just stay looped in. You're never going to stop learning. If you stop learning, you're doing something wrong.
So, where can people find you and support and learn from your work?
Well, thank you. Online and email is really the best resource, and I've been around long enough now that if you just type in Mike Vermont got weeds with a question mark, I'll pop up on your screen. Email's the best way. And I do publish things, so there are plenty of little published articles. The best place to encounter people like me is, again, at the conferences, which happen all over the country, but not enough people go to. And I'll give an example, biocontrol. That's using biology to control biology. So insects to control plants, or plants to control plants. I go to these meetings and there are no beverage makers at these meetings. So why is that important? Well, you need clean water to make beverages, whether it's milk, soda, wine, cider, beer. Invasive exotic species affect water quality because they affect erosion and they affect the ability of the land to function in a complete manner. So you would think invasive species, landscape impacts, water impacts. Why are there no beverage makers at these conferences, or people directly involved with with water quality. So we need more people. We need broader attendance at some of these events, some of these conferences, whether it's biocontrol or integrated pest management or farm conferences, agricultural conferences, forestry. My colleague over there in Ireland is thrilled. He's doing plant extracts to manage Japanese knotweed. And
Excellent.
I suggested to him, I'm going to link you up with a few observations that I've made here in Vermont, because I'm seeing where Japanese knotweed tends to just come to a screeching halt when it encounters certain other plants. So he's over there with his laboratory doing studies on how to use plant extracts to control other species, the growth of other species. So you can see that it's a network. I don't want to say networking and be loosely, I don't want to be just throw it out there, but being a willing to share in networks that exist, you will benefit. It may be years before somebody circles back to you, but the power of networking in an honest, open way is absolutely priceless. Critical to what we do.
I love that, and I think, the fact that I'm not sure that everyone is making the connections between clean water and invasive species and things. So I think that's something, hopefully that's something that you brought attention to today with this podcast episode. But I want to really thank you so much for your time and just your willingness to share all of your knowledge with others. I think it's just so needed and so appropriate and much appreciated.
Thank you in return. Thank you so much.
If you haven't yet visited your local Green Online Hub, then please visit gogreenlocally.org and check out the directories for events, groups, businesses, online resources, and local support listings for your area. If you find something is missing, then let us know or just log in and add it. These are community free sharing directories.